This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. I am grateful for your company on this summer-like, early autumn day. In the next half hour, we will dive into the aftermath of a tumultuous, sometimes deadly summer in Charlottesville. Conversations about race and inequality continue there as a collaboration of counseling and wellness centers work together to help heal the city's trauma after 812, as it is sometimes now called. And the subject of our Women of Interest profile this week is a woman in Charlottesville working to open up opportunities for people of color and break down barriers to mental health there. But first, 40 years ago, bald eagles were in danger of extinction, but they have made a big rebound, and theirs is now considered an Endangered Species Act success story. But as they spread across Virginia in search of new habitat, they are finding some free lunches that are actually quite costly. WMRA's Christopher Clymer Kurtz reports.
When Curtis Blosser goes hunting, or just out to shoot on his family's Rockingham County farm, he certainly doesn't intend to kill bald eagles. Even when his gun works.
All right, Dad. Your gun doesn't work!
He said that hunters are conservationists who love the wild.
This one's gonna be loud!
But hunters may be partly responsible for a problem that is harming eagles. Lead poisoning, not from being shot, but from bullet remains, lead fragments.
You ready?
I've never heard of this before. So I just started talking to my buddies at hunt, and we were like, man, how can this happen?
The vast majority of the bald eagles we get, and that's 35 to 40 birds a year, the vast majority have lead in their bloodstream.
Ed Clark is the president and founder of the Wildlife Center of Virginia, a training hospital for wildlife near Waynesboro. He published a paper on lead toxicity in raptors, which include bald eagles.
People just don't get the connection. They have the idea that, okay, I'm going to go hunt deer. I shoot the deer. There's an entry wound. There's an exit wound. The bullet's gone out. It's in the ground someplace. No problem. I'm not responsible. What people don't recognize is that the average rifle bullet, as an example, loses about 30% of its weight as it passes through the deer or the other game animal. And those little shards of lead, a piece the size of a grain of rice, is enough to kill a bald eagle. And it's there. It's definitely there.
A lot of hunters field dress their quarry, gut out the organs, and leave them out in the woods to decompose or for scavengers, which can include bald eagles.
Those remains left in the field carry little toxic time bombs. Lead is a toxic substance, and the trouble is it builds up. So if they get a little bit this year and don't get any until next year, what they got this year is still in them when they get the next dose. And so eventually it'll compromise or kill the bird.
At his dining room table, Curtis Blosser comes to grips with Clark's concerns.
If they're finding fragments, it's definitely, I mean, you can't make up a fragment.
Blosser works construction jobs for much of the year, but in the fall months and into January, he travels a lot to Wisconsin, New Jersey, Kentucky, even Mexico, and elsewhere, filming hunts for television hunting shows. He said that in professional hunting, deer aren't gutted in the woods for the sake of pictures and mess. That's not how he was raised, though.
That's like the ritual. Like you kill your first deer, and my dad is looking over and hands you your knife. He says, all right, son, you killed a deer, you got it. That's part of it.
Blosser's guess is that the lead fragments that raptors consume aren't coming solely from the remains of deer killed by bullets from high-powered rifles.
Like groundhogs, skunks, possums, anything that a farmer sees is going to... I mean, we shoot groundhogs all year long. We usually use 22s, and most of the times that will not go through the animal.
Clark said that 22 bullets, which are often pure lead, can be even worse than high-powered rifle bullet remains. But he also said that when he maps out the data across a calendar, he sees a direct relationship between the incidence and frequency of lead toxicity and hunting season. Blosser also suspects that some hunting methods, more than others, result in higher amounts of lead available to scavengers.
East of the Blue Ridge, a lot of counties allow use of dogs when deer hunting. You run them like bear. And a lot of times you use shotguns with buckshot.
So that'd be a lot more lead.
And so that'd be a lot more lead.
In 1991, the federal government banned lead birdshot for waterfowl hunting. But recent attempts to ban lead bullets have served only to polarize public debate about guns and hunting. The outgoing Obama administration issued a last-minute directive against using lead bullets on federal lands, which the Trump administration promptly overturned. Given the polarization of that public debate, Clark thinks that the lead toxicity problem in raptors can be dealt with more surgically, by hunters, voluntarily. They just need to use copper instead of lead bullets when they're actually out hunting, or bury or carry away the dead animal remains so birds can't get them. Getting hunters to do those things may be an uphill battle.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, as far as like the all copper and all that, it hasn't really caught on around here.
Ron Shiflett is the sporting goods manager at the Rockingham Cooperative in Timberville.
Like everybody else, it's kind of not converting over unless somebody actually wants them, we'll order them. But as far as stocking them, we're not doing that right now. Because of the clientele of people.
Why don't they want them?
It's because it's tradition. They just been using this type of bullet all the time.
As for not leaving the field dressings from deer out in the field?
They'd have to fight with me for I take a tub of guts home.
Ed Clark said that in hunter safety training, hunters are taught that they are responsible for each bullet they shoot from the time they pull the trigger until it stops, but that's not quite good enough.
We simply need to amend that to say you're responsible for your bullet from the instant you pull the trigger and it leaves the gun, even after it stops moving. That's the nuance.
Nuanced or not, fall deer hunting seasons are just around the corner. For WMRA News, I'm Christopher Clymer-Kurtz.
It has been more than a month since a white supremacist rally in Charlottesville left 3 people dead and dozens more injured. The city has since attempted to piece itself back together, realizing that deeper issues are also at play. For a look towards the future, WMRA's Jordy Yeager spoke with educators and teens about their reality.
I honestly thought this was a wake-up call for us.
Kimani Alexander was born and raised in Charlottesville. He's 20 years old and works in a grocery store in the city, stocking shelves. The violence of August 12th, he says, was horrible. But for the first time, he's seeing a chance at real change.
We're seeing people from the community come out. It's good to see white people come out, more than black people, to, you know, show support. Because they have most of the voice, you know. So I think it's a huge wake-up call. It's an opportunity to tackle the problem and to address the problem if we have any chance to address the problem. So,
sitting in his family's living room with his mom on the front porch, I ask him, what is the problem?
We need equality. Ethnicity shouldn't matter. It's no equality. It's hard to explain, man.
And it is hard to explain, but people are trying. In the 2 city council meetings since August 12th, large crowds have pleaded with city government for more affordable housing, for racial equity in the foster care system, for greater police accountability with African Americans. Alexander and his peers say the city isn't designed for their success, and August 12th was a window into that reality.
And I think white people around like here are starting to see that because it happened down here. Like, you're realizing, like, it could happen to anyone. And I feel like white people need to be put in black people's shoes. Like, if you was black, would you really want to chance it? Like, your kid not coming home or really be scared to send them to school?
Inside city schools, a similar conversation is happening. Dr. Eric Irizarry is the principal of Charlottesville High School, home to more than 1,200 kids. Days after August 12th and weeks before the first day of class, Irizarry and his team lined up mental health counselors for students and teachers.
We had a plan for kids that were in trauma immediately. We knew they were going to be in trauma. We identified the students that were involved in the actual incidents, whether it was the vehicle attack or any of the other attacks that occurred throughout the city. And, you know, we made sure we touched base with them. How are you doing? We're here for you.
About 2 weeks in now, Irizarry said the healing's begun, and students and teachers are beginning to look at the long-term effects, stepping up asking what can they do? How can they get involved? It's created an opportunity, a way to look deeper, he said.
I think one of the unintended consequences of the events of August 12th is that it sparked a dialogue. I think some folks their eyes were open to some of the injustices that have been, that have happened in the past and some of those scars that haven't healed. And I think sometimes the perception is everything is fine. I think there's some citizens that would maybe argue that point. It's a great city, but we do have issues that we need to address. We have some inequalities that we need to address. And our students are aware of that.
Last week, the city school board held its first meeting since August 12th, and some of those inequalities were brought up. Former city councilor Dee Dee Smith presented board members with some recent data, detailing how about 60 city families requested to change schools last year, about half white, half black, but their approvals were not as equitable.
If you were one of 33 requests to transfer a white child, you had a 98% chance of approval. But if you were one of 27 requests to transfer a black child, your chances dropped to about 50%.
Lamia West is a 16-year-old senior at CHS. She's also a high school representative on the city school board. At last week's meeting, she nodded in agreement to the data. West has been in advanced classes since elementary. That's where it starts, she said. You find your group and you stay with it. Transferring schools allows for those groups to be more diverse and for more African Americans to be in more advanced classes.
And as I sit in my more advanced classes, I am one of few African Americans that sit there with me. This is our chance to do better. This is a new era in which we can teach that everyone has equal opportunities. It's not just said on paper, but there's proof. As everyone sits in this class and we see different types of faces, different types of skin, and we're all learning together as a whole.
Juan Diego Wade is a career counselor, a lifelong educator, and chairman of the Charlottesville School Board. Last week, he thanked Smith and West for raising the issues. Part of racism is certainly structural, he told me, but it's also deeply personal. It involves interactions between individuals, interactions that need changing, one by one.
But it takes time. Unfortunately, it didn't happen overnight, and the change is not going to take place overnight.
On the first day of school this year, Wade welcomed kids outside an elementary school. One father dropped his son off at first grade, but the youngster was unsure of where to go. So Wade, who's African American, reached out his hand and offered to show him. And the boy, who's white, took it.
I walked him down to his classroom, and he was talking with me about how much he was looking forward to meeting his new teachers and his new friends, that he's ready. He is ready to start school, to start his life, to start the next 12 or 13 years of education. If he's ready, I'm ready.
For WMRA News, I'm Jordy Yeager.
So the conversations about race and inequality since the violence of August 12th seem even more urgent. But how can people deal with the mental and physical trauma from that violent day? Several groups are providing free or low-cost counseling and wellness services to the residents of Charlottesville, as WMRA's Marguerite Gallerini reports.
Political anger and frustration persist in Charlottesville, as does the community's need to process the tragic events of that day and heal. That's why free counseling and wellness services are being offered around town. Soft music and tranquility greets anyone entering Common Ground Healing Arts.
We do acupuncture, yoga, massage, and meditation on a pay-what-you-can ranges basis.
Elliot Brown is the executive director of this nonprofit wellness center, located on the second floor of the Heritage Center in Charlottesville. She saw the benefits of this therapy herself.
I was down at the rally on August 12th and never really experiencing trauma much myself. I wasn't aware of the power of the body work that we do on that level. And we had set up some free services in conjunction with the Women's Initiative. I went over there and had some body work, specifically called Zero Balancing. It's a kind of massage, but it has some energy work in it as well. And once I had that, I thought everybody needed to have access to that.
That's how the idea of creating the Seville Wellness Fund came up.
Our goal is to be able to offer free services to everybody who needs it, but the money has to come first, so we're slowly rolling that out and people are receiving services. We've raised a little bit over $2,000. We've quietly set this off because we don't really want to compete with the other GoFundMe accounts that some of the victims have put up.
Callie Gaston, an acupuncturist who's been working at Common Ground for 3 years now, thinks it is a wonderful initiative.
I think that the intervention early on after trauma so that it doesn't lodge in us is very important. And the five-needle protocol that we use is the same thing that Acupuncturists Without Borders uses. They used it after Katrina to work on first responders. It's a really lovely way of helping support somebody. It's sort of like hitting the reset button.
Not far from Common Ground, you will find an old house on 4th Street called On Our Own. It is a peer-based nonprofit, and here the mood is very convivial.
Yes, the Yellow House of Miracles. We're a small mom and pop, but we do big things.
Cindy Richardson is a certified peer support specialist at On Our Own.
Traditional therapists may say, "Tell me how that makes you feel." Well, here at On Our Own, we say, "I know that's how that feels. This is what I did when that happened to me." See, there's a common bond. So that's what we do. We provide support through our experience.
Since August 12th, Richardson says they've had to amp up their groups.
We have fragile beings here, and we have found that so many times we go through things and we are told it's not that bad. Get over it. You'll be okay. We found what that does. It compounds and it builds until you explode in one way or another, mentally, physically. It's going to come out. So why not come out in an easy, releasing way
Bill Johnson, who's come to On Our Own for about 7 months now, has seen a huge difference. He especially likes how the members of this house are connected beyond social categories.
The socioeconomic differences outside the house are no longer present in the house, or racial differences, religious differences, whatever artificial ways that we separate ourselves. There's much more connectivity with being human. Shared experiences.
Another provider of more traditional therapy is the Counseling Alliance of Virginia, a community-based outpatient mental health clinic in northern Charlottesville. They also provide massage therapy and Reiki, says Gene Cash, the CEO and executive director of the center.
What we're seeing right now just recently is first the initial reaction to August 12th, the anger, the frustration, the disbelief. And right now we're starting to see people or hear from people more about, oh, I thought I was doing okay, but these thoughts, these memories are starting to intrude. I think I need to come in and talk to somebody.
That's for the individual sessions they provide, but they also have group support sessions on Tuesday nights.
8-12, as they call it, that was an event, okay? What I'm looking to capture is the momentum that's been going on for years in this community of communicating how we can help heal every day, not just from 8-12.
For more free counseling and wellness therapy options, you can visit the Facebook page of the Community Mental Health and Wellness Coalition. For WMRA News, I am Marguerite Gallerini.
Finally, for the latest installment of our Women of Interest series, Jordi Yeager met a woman who is dedicated to breaking down not just barriers to mental wellness, but also barriers for African Americans in Charlottesville.
Ebony Bug is one of a very small handful of licensed clinical social workers in Charlottesville who is African American. In fact, she's one of an even smaller handful who's also a woman. So if you're a female of color wanting a therapist that looks like you, that understands your reality and the trauma that comes with it, Ebony's who you turn to. And that's why she got into this work. Growing up, she didn't have that.
I wish I had a me when I was growing up. I wish my whole family had, you know, someone in their corner encouraging healing and wellness as a right, as opposed to a luxury or something for later on. And so it's, you know, I think back to all of the women in my family, and, you know, there's this saying that if you heal one generation, you heal sort of seven generations back. And so I think as a parent, my goal is to, you know, create an opportunity for this next generation to have a sense of wellness that wasn't as easily available to me.
For the last 5 years, she's been program director at the Women's Initiative, a mental health nonprofit that offers a sliding fee scale, ensuring that money and access aren't barriers to mental wellness for women. Ebony's office was upstairs from where we met, in the courtyard of the Jefferson School, the first grade school where, in 1865, the white Charlottesville government stopped preventing African Americans from learning. Barriers in Charlottesville are nothing new for African Americans, but Ebony recently shifted how she tackles them. This past June, she became the senior manager for diversity, inclusion, and outreach at the Mind and Life Institute.
It's an organization that really works towards supporting an understanding of the relationship between contemplation and the sciences. So their mission is to alleviate human suffering.
Contemplative practices include meditation, mindfulness, and yoga, but also things such as prayer, dance, and even some forms of exercise. So contemplative sciences is the study of those practices to see if they can improve our lives. For example, what if teachers use meditation as an alternative to in-school suspension? Crazy, right? But what if there was scientific research that proved it worked? That's where the Mind and Life Institute comes in. But
organizations like Mind and Life have really noble missions. And yet, in practice, their organizational structure and the demographics of the organization and maybe even some organizational practices may still reinforce societal imbalances.
For example, following the violence of August 11th and 12th in Charlottesville, millions of dollars have been raised across town. But most of that's been going to established nonprofits, many of which are run by white middle and upper class people. The funds have yet to make it to many organizations led by people of color or historically disenfranchised groups who may not have 501c3 status.
And yet they may be providing the most innovative way of healing or supporting or even knowing and understanding their communities. You know, if we're just redistributing these funds, for example, to the same organizations who've been doing it for a while, and yet we're still seeing these inherent structural problems, is there another way that we can begin to look at that?
These aren't as obvious as a Ku Klux Klan robe or a swastika, but they are ways of functioning designed by and for white people. So how do you convince those people with power that we'd all be better off if they empowered others?
Oftentimes when we talk about, you know, redistribution of power, it runs counter actually to someone's identity as a good person. And so it's not trying to change their notion of themselves. It's about expanding the definition of what that good person looks like.
At the Mind and Life Institute, Ebony's one of the few African Americans on staff. A while back, she went to the University of Virginia, where only 7% of students are African American. So much of why things don't change is because it doesn't occur to people in power to do them differently. Recently, Ebony took her 16-year-old daughter to a back-to-school night. They met with teachers, saw old friends and parents, and talked about their summer vacations. But they saw surprisingly few of the school's African American students and parents. Why? Maybe it was held at a time or in a way that they couldn't make it with work and other life obligations.
If half of the student body's parents were unable to attend, and I know that they care about the education and well-being of their children, then what is the actual answer? Do we just keep having the event at the very same time? Or do we, you know, step outside of our comfort zones and do something a little bit differently to respond?
So what would it look like if our community was truly inclusive? Ebony is hoping to find out. For WMRA News, I'm Jordy Yeager.
Support for WMRA's Women of Interest series comes from F&M Bank, a local independent community bank since 1908 with locations throughout the Shenandoah Valley. Online at fmbankva.com.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Les and Johnny Grady, Klein May Realty, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, Nancy Barber, Pam and Jim Huggins, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of the Community Foundation of Harrisonburg in Rockingham County. If you'd like to support our news coverage, go to WMRA.org, mouse over News, then click on News and Information Fund. All our stories are archived at that website. And be sure to click like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio and follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. Don't forget to keep up each morning with the WMRA Daily, our new weekday early morning news podcast. Listen at WMRA.org and you can sign up for the podcast there or wherever fine podcasts are available. I'm Bob Levicki, WMRA's news director and Morning Edition host. I will talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.